right? And there is no, in order, I know you mentioned common ground, but what if you can't get to common ground? What do you do?
You know,
I know you said we're doomed if we don't really.
You know, every group has somebody like that. It doesn't matter. You can be a really effective board, and there's always somebody who takes up a little more time or is extremely negative or
disruptive.
Those things happen a lot. You know, a lot of times a board chair just needs to learn how to manage dynamics in a group. I would also just say, and it may not sound realistic, but you know, if you've got 20 people on the board and you've got two people that are doing that, the presentation and the attitude of the other 18 people will influence how effective that is. You know,
at Pacifica?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I do think that. I do think that if you've got one or two people who are still intent on being disruptive and negative, and you've got 18 people who have decided within themselves that they are not going to do that, there will be an impact.
Thank you. The more I listen, the more I develop a sense of curiosity, especially when you said something about the uniqueness of Pacifica. Now, I can only speak for WPFW, and I'm fortunate to be a good friend of the person whose voice was the first on the airwaves. And I think at times like this, it would do us well to get a sense of the history of this organization, because what I understand from it is that when WPFW started, there were only volunteers in a little room with a little box. As a result, the organization became volunteers. They were trained, and a lot of people in mainstream media have come from WPFW. So having had that information, I don't see how difficult it is to have volunteers who have invested 30 years and more of a Saturday or whatever, holding on to a piece of the cake. What I think is a problem, though, is that across the board, there is not the same culture of volunteerism. Mm-hmm. We have stations that even the volunteers are paid people. And I believe, the programmers are paid people. In PFW, we do not have any paid volunteers. And
if you're paid, you're not a volunteer.
No, our programmers. We do not have paid programmers. I'm sorry. But they are volunteers. And I don't think we should actually make a distinction between who manages the paid, unpaid programmers and the paid staff.
Mm-hmm.
After all, the general manager is supposed to be the person responsible for the day-to-day business of the station, which is programming.
Okay.
And I think I got a sense of a distinction being made as to who is responsible for the volunteers.
I think that what we're talking about is a distinction in the duties of management that may not necessarily have to do with supervision, that a volunteer coordinator might be responsible for recruiting volunteers, for scheduling them, for making sure that there's recognition, for making sure time is tracked, but that a chief executive, or in this case even a general manager, might be responsible for making sure that policies, that overall station or foundation policies are followed. Okay. And there's a difference there that doesn't necessarily have to do with supervision.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that certainly at our station, and I think at most of the stations, there's a distinction between unpaid staff and volunteers. So a producer who's on the air without a salary is still considered staff. And a volunteer is somebody who might come in to answer phones or stuff envelopes or work in other kinds of categories. So a volunteer coordinator to me makes sense for those people who are coming in and just giving a couple of hours of their time. But a producer who's on the air providing, our mission really to the air, would be under the category of staff, whether they're paid or not.
Okay, so let me address it this way, is that you can call people unpaid staff if you like. That's fine, and you can categorize them any way you like, but the fact is they're volunteers. That doesn't have anything to do with whether or not there's who they report to. Now, a volunteer coordinator, as I said, may have brought people in to do certain things, and they may not have. Somebody else may have brought them in. But the volunteer coordinator might be responsible for tracking their time, that may only mean going to a program director and asking for their volunteer timesheets. That may be the only process. That's up to a station manager to develop a process. But that a volunteer maybe somebody volunteers to come in and file papers. That person may be assigned to the secretary, and that may be their supervisor, but there's still a volunteer coordinator that's coordinating the activities to make sure that your overall resource of volunteers is strong and stable and growing and happy. Okay. Does that make sense?
Because it doesn't really, I think what you both said can exist in a parallel universe.
Yeah, it absolutely can. If I go to an organization and I say, you know, I really like what your organization does and I'd like to give some time, here's what I do. And then they say, well, gosh, we really could use a grant writer. I'm not going to report to the volunteer coordinator. I'm going to report to the development director, and I'm going to work with the development director. Now, the development director is going to let that volunteer coordinator know that I'm still showing up, that I'm happy, that these are the things I need. That volunteer coordinator may call and ask me how things are going. They may send me a note saying thanks for your help. You know, they may want to ask me if I've given how much and many hours I've contributed last month. But I work and report to a development director. Does that answer it?
Yeah.
Okay.
The key question for a lot of us, and I think we need to be transparent here, is the unpaid staff, and we all have that. And that sets to another classification of volunteer. And so I still consider them to be volunteers. However, if they produce a show or whatever, they too should have someone that they report to.
Absolutely.
And a description of what they do, the time that they're in, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think we need to, and still we can recognize them and maybe figure out a way to.
It's only fair to volunteers that they know what's expected of them.
Exactly.
Who they should report to, who they should call if they can't show up, you know, all of those kinds of things. They should have job descriptions. They should agree to a set of expectations on behavior and responsibilities. Now, you know, with regard to, you know, unpaid staff, you guys can develop a policy that says, you know, volunteers that do these things get input on something. That can be part of your policy.
That's
but
true.
Your volunteer program should encompass your overall volunteer piece.
It seems to be a matter of semantics anyway, because some staff probably are more valuable than other staff, and some volunteers may be more valuable than other volunteers. But they're all necessary in order to make the machine work, and so they all deserve to be given credit for being there, period. I forgot the point I was making, but I guess that'll do.
But that's a good one.
Yeah, everybody's important.
I think one of the, at least from my perception, one of the reasons why there's confusion has to do with what the category is for running for office. I mean, for the LSB and for the national board, and that is the distinction between staff and listener member. And staff, both categories, can have volunteers. And at KPFT, we have 200. Folks who count as staff who are associated with being on the air. So that and that distinction, frankly, causes us a great deal of difficulty and has caused us a great deal of ambiguity and challenges and so forth across the entire network. But I thank you very much for your offer of giving a volunteer policy. There's an unbelievable organization in Houston called the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. They have 14,000 volunteers, and those volunteers, if they screw up, they are fired. And they operate with a full HR sort of approach. They know what their jobs are, and they do them, and they also govern that organization. And we need that kind of clarity so that people don't just run away with what the stations do.
And you do need clarity. I will say that if an organization is running off of 14,000 volunteers, it's not just that if they don't meet expectations, they're fired. It's also that that organization does a good job of making those people feel valued.
It is one of the most exciting places in Houston to be and one of the most valued. Exactly.
Now with regard to your question about elections, you know, I don't have an opinion on that one way or the other, and if I did, I probably wouldn't tell you. But I will say this, that whatever policy you decide on, it's dependent upon consistently tracking data and hours and information and doing that the same way across the organization. That's whatever you decide, that's what it's dependent on. And that comes down to a volunteer program. That's not a policy, that's volunteer program operations. And those things need to take, you know, an important priority. Okay, so let's move on quickly now to this board and staff responsibilities chart. Now, again, these are guidelines. They may be appropriate for your particular organization. They may not. But these are kind of general guidelines on who might be responsible for different aspects of organizational operations. In planning, directing the process of planning, which was your question before, typically would be the board, and the board chair would probably initiate that. Of course, anything that says board should be done in consultation with your chief executive. Anything that says staff should probably go back to the board at one point or another just for input. Providing input to long-range goals, that should never be done by one entity or the other. You've got to have ownership on all sides. Approving your long-range goals, that's a board responsibility. And tracking how those goals are being met is your responsibility. Formulating those objectives that have to go with those goals, that's up to the staff. So in other words, if you have a goal of bringing in $2 million in large donations, that's the goal that this board set. It's up to the staff to go back and say, this is what we're going to do and how we're going to go about meeting that goal. And I will say that, you know, when you start tying this to staff responsibilities, chief executive responsibilities, it's a good idea to always set your objectives in a measurable way. You want to say to someone, by this date, we would like to see this many blanks be done, or we would like to see this percentage of improvement. And that's how you can tie in and protect yourself in staff evaluations, that you can't evaluate a staff person, a chief executive, if they don't have clear, consistent, measurable objectives that you've given them. And then you can evaluate whether or not they've met them. Okay? Approving your objectives, that's the board. Preparing reports on the achievement of the goals and objectives, that's for staff to do. They prepare those reports and they give them to you, and you monitor them. All right, programming, assessing community needs, that's a staff thing. Now, I believe that you guys have community boards. Oh, you have community advisory boards, that's right. So now a community advisory board should represent the community and should tell you what your community needs are. But a community advisory board, I was on the community advisory board for KCET, the public television station out here, probably about 15 years ago. Your community advisory boards need to have staff guide them. A staff needs to go in and say, these are the things we want to know. What's happening in your communities that we need to address? What kinds of things are we not doing? I can remember that there was something about breast cancer programming funding at one time, and they came to us and they said, you know, we need you to assemble organizations and people that have experience in breast cancer research and breast cancer experiences among women. They went to the community advisory board to get those. That should be your resource for what's happening out there. But you can't leave them on their own. Your board, I mean, I'm sorry, I would say that your executives are probably, do you have, there's one for each station, is that correct? So possibly a general manager would be assigned to guiding that community advisory board and at least asking them for what kind of information they want. That's one example. Training volunteer leaders, that's staff. Overseeing the evaluation would be a board. Preparing budget would be a staff, and finalizing and approving the budget would be up to the board. Making sure that expenditures are within budget is up to staff, but monitoring that, of course, is always up to the board. You need to monitor that. Now, I can remember, I guess the first couple of times that I used to be on the finance committee years ago before I got out of here, but I never understood why finance reports were not accepted by the board. Any organization usually that gets a financial report and reviews it then moves for acceptance and inclusion in the minutes. This is something that this board needs to do. You either need to accept those financial reports and include them in the minutes that they have been reviewed and accepted by you, or you need to not do that. You need to specifically not do that.
Say that you think they're accurate, or does that just mean that means, we acknowledge that we got them?
It means that you need to accept into the minutes that you got them and that they are either accepted without question or they are accepted with question or with concern, and you need to document that.
I'm reading, I'm guessing, I'm judging that you're saying that we need to read them, understand them, so that we can make judgments on them.
Yes, and you need to demand that they be given to you in a format that is readable and understandable and consistent across units.
Yeah, I think one of the issues is that there is not...
I think one of the issues is that it isn't completely clear what the financial information, you know, its accuracy, what it is over time, and all of that. And so I'm with Wendy about providing sufficient caveats around the action of accepting them, mm-hmm. that just reading them and talking with people about them may not be enough to give real confidence in them.
I would, so the question then would be that if there was nothing in your minutes that showed that you had sufficient questions and something happened, would there be an assumption then that you read those financial statements and you accepted them? I would say that there would be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we currently have a report from the auditor that tells us that there are incredibly serious problems. And that then raises, you know, the question of what acceptance of those financials mean in a given report.
I would say that in your audit statement that, I mean, I obviously I don't know the details and I don't want to go into the details,
right.
But that the action the board takes may be something that says we have reviewed and discussed the audit, we are accepting it.
The audit, I mean individual financials.
Okay. We accept them as part of the minutes and have instructed these corrective actions. Yes.
And or either will review, give a recommendation to review, follow up, look at corrective actions or anything like that. It only means because that's a part of our fiduciary responsibility.
Yes.
We own this corporation.
That's right.
And if and when it goes down, so may our homes and all of our property or whatever we own. Well, you know, that's far-fetched, but, you know. But, you know,
yeah.
it could be challenged that way. And so I think once we understand the depth of our responsibilities, we can then figure out ways to finagle this.
Well, and also, if you look at it more in a more from a more positive framework, is how do you grow your organization if you don't know where you are right now?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To follow on to the last speaker, I have nothing for anybody to get, so maybe. But you know, I'd like you to speak to the notion that. And this is my view. Our fiduciary responsibilities seem to be limited around this table. And I have a concern because I think as a listener, putting my listener hat on, I contribute to this thing. And I do not believe that our listeners get the chance to discuss where the money is going. I'd like you to address that point for me.
Does your organization have public comment, annual meetings, opportunities for volunteers to participate in a budgeting process?
You want me to answer?
Yes.
You just said to us earlier to be careful how we speak, so I would reserve my judgment. I think the question itself would indicate what I'm saying in that. I do not believe that we are giving our listeners an opportunity to participate in either making recommendations or even understanding how the money is being spent. It's no good putting it on the internet when, in fact, the people that we're hoping to reach are those voiceless people. How many of them have internets, I don't know. But I am not sure that we do have the process through which we would reach those people and have them have a better sense of how we're spending their money.
I guess that my response to that would be in the form of another question back to you, which would be, what will be the process that this board takes to identify exactly what the source of those problems are and how you'll address them to improve your communication.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Good. To speak to
Lizette's point. Do you have open finance committee meetings at W?
As I said, I think the question I asked would tell a lot more than I actually said.
Okay. So do you require membership for the finance committee meetings or is it open? We're supposed to have a finance committee.
I think I'll say it again. The question I ask would tell the story more than I would say.
The answer to... You want to give the answer?
You go ahead.
The answer to the question is no, we don't have open finance committee meetings.
Why not?
Was it membership?
It doesn't mean that we won't. It just said that we haven't had.
Okay. Well, I would say that you need to decide what your policy is, and you need to make sure that the policy is followed.
So are we talking about Pacifica, or are we talking about the separate stations? Because are the same rules going to apply to both? Because my concern more than anything is that there is a sense of transparency to start with. You can't bring up a budget that can't be proven whether it makes sense or not. So there has to be transparency to start with, that information is coming forth correctly, and then you can decide on whether it is something that you want to make amend or make suggestions.
So your initial question was, are we talking about stations or are we talking about Pacifica? As the board of directors of the Pacifica Foundation, you are always talking about the Pacifica Foundation as a whole and what the policies for the foundation are. And you may decide that it's appropriate at times to set policies that allow different units to set guidelines within the parameters you set. You may say that, you know, this, we're going to leave these pieces up to the station as long as you do A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. That might be appropriate.
Let me pose it this way. Is there anything within our financial budget that we cannot be completely transparent about with the listeners?
You can provide salary ranges for either staff positions or staff position categories, but you should not give out specific salaries for specific individuals. You should not disclose any type of major financial decisions that have to do with major things like acquisitions until those kinds of things are considered complete. Dan will, I'm sure, give you more, and I'm not going to give you legal advice because I'm not an attorney. You should not disclose things that might have to do with putting aside money for specific legal action, although you may say that, you know, we've got so much in reserve for legal action until after a legal action is completed, and then you may report out on what that specific amount was. You know, I think the rest of that you need to get from Dan. With regard to being able to know what your financial statements say, I will just say as a guideline that you should request a complete chart of accounts that's consistent across all units with a definition of what those accounts are, what's included in each account, and to ensure that all units are accounting for things the same way. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to follow your budget. That's one thing you may request as a policy, that annually staff gives you that, that annually staff shows you any changes that are made to a chart of accounts. These are policy decisions that you can just give a list and say, every year we expect to see these things.
Quick clarification. We do have at our LSB meetings, we do ask for financial reports that are given, and they are public.
Mm-hmm. Should be public.
And they are.
Yeah.
And they are. But when the Finance Committee meets, it's not normally advertised as being a public meeting, and from now on we will do that.
That's a policy decision. I mean, you're not legally required to have open financial meetings. That's a policy decision based on Pacifica transparency, you know.
CPB.
But I think the bylaws say something.
Yeah, and CPB.
Well, but your CPB rules for public meetings mean that your financial statements need to be available to anyone who wants to see them. You're not required to say, you know, we need to have this many people in a public meeting. You can have, of course, if somebody's going to show up at your finance meeting, you should let them in and let them listen.
Sure.
But those things are policy decisions that you need. And if the board focuses on maintaining policy, setting policy and making sure that your policy is followed, you'll take a big step towards, you know, actually moving the organization along rather than focusing on, you know, day-to-day minutia. Focus on policy. Okay, so let's not, because time is running short, let's not go through each of these individually, but just take a look at these charts, and these may give you an idea of in different types of organizational operation categories, a general rule for who might take lead responsibility on something, whether it's the board or whether it's staff or whether it's a joint responsibility together. This is something you might use as a guideline. Okay. So the next thing we're going to talk about is building trust between boards and staff. And boards and staff.
Did you give us a handout?
Israel's passing that out right now.
Oh. May I ask the chair, what's our time?
We have 15 minutes more.
Oh, 15, thank you.
Is there going to be a break in between the two presentations? Well, we have promised Dan 45 minutes.
The break's at 5.
And at 5 we're going to dinner, so. I'm out. how many of you would like a 5-minute break between this presentation and Dan's presentation? Put your hand up if you would. Okay, how many would just as soon keep going? Put your hand up if you would just as soon keep going. Okay, the question was raised, and we want to do this quickly, of taking a break. You know what? This is coming out of your time. We're going to finish this, and then we'll worry about it.
Okay, so Israel is passing out a handout on building trust between boards and staff. Basically, the first sentence on this is that trust is the fundamental quality of successful, productive, sustainable relationships. That means it's the most important thing towards building your organization is trust among members of the board, between board and staff, that you've got to make a sincere effort to build this. If you look at this little chart, you have one column that lists aspects of an organization that is rooted in culture, in a culture of distrust and fear. The other one, you have an organization that's rooted in a culture built on trust. Typically, when we do, you know, larger, longer trainings with organizations, what we do is we have them evaluate themselves based on these. And in most cases, most organizations can identify probably two or three things on the negative column. So I want you to take just a second to look at that and decide how many of these in the negative column you feel you need to work on and how many you're good in on the positive side. So we've got, on each side, we've got 8 aspects. Do you feel you're at about 2 or 3 on the negative? Yes. There's 8. All right. So if you're thinking you've got more than 2 or 3, you may really want to take a look at this and prioritize which ones you want to work on the most, which ones you're going to work on first.
What do you mean by work on? How is that done?
Well, if you are looking at something where there is minimal collaboration, what steps is this board going to take to ensure collaboration among its members? This is something you have to honestly consider, and you may need to include in your planning process. You know, that what collaboration means to this particular group and how you're going to achieve it. If it may be that you decide that it's the negative gossip, then what steps are you going to take to make sure that not only do you not contribute to it, but how does the organization set itself up so that it knows how to appropriately deal with that to avoid liability? You know? All right. So we won't go again through all of these because we don't have a lot of time, but you've got in here different ideas on how to invoke a set of ground rules to build trust. You know, basically, how do you want to be treated? How do you expect others to be treated? How are you going to ensure those happen? Does that mean that you have a code of ethics that everybody needs to follow? Does that mean that you have guidelines for how you expect volunteers to behave when they're representing Pacifica or when they are at Pacifica events or on Pacifica property? How will those things be enforced? And how will you ensure that those things are not enforced in a way that takes over all of your time and effort? How are you going to measure how things are going? And that can be a little tricky, but, you know, that's something that can be negotiated in a group. And then there's some things that have to do with trust-based leadership, which falls to you directly. as leaders of the organization, are you operating individually in a way that's trustworthy and that inspires trust among your colleagues? All right, what Israel's passing out now is a little handout that has to do with board contact with staff. In a lot of organizations, you know, board does not interact with staff at all. In other organizations, board members interact with staff all of the time. I will say that in my organization, if board members were going directly to staff and giving them direction, I'd have a quick talking to with that board member. That compromises a supervisor's ability to supervise. Yeah, that it sets up ways for people in management positions to be undermined. Now, that doesn't mean that board members should be off limits to staff. In fact, sometimes when board members are off limits to staff, that builds a sense of distrust. That builds a separateness between board and staff, you know, that the board is up there and doesn't know what's going on. They're making decisions and they have no idea what we're doing. But there are some guidelines that have to do with board members interacting with staff. And those things have to do with just letting supervisors know that if you have something, for example, you need to talk to a development director about, or you need information about what's going on in the development office, your job would be to go to the chief executive, to the ED, and say, hey, this is the information I need. Is it okay with you if I talk to the ED, or would you please let the ED call, or would you please have the development director call me? So that the ED knows that you're not going behind their back, you're not going over and above them, you're letting them know what you're talking to them about and what they are. And in return, that development director now has an assignment from their supervisor to work with a board member on this. That board members maybe have committees where they need a staff person to work with them on that committee, then you need to have the ED assign that staff person to work with the committee and report back. But it's all about communication, making sure that before you go in and ask a staff person for information or paper or something, that that person who's in charge, the person that you are responsible for supervising, which is the ED, knows that you're what you're doing and what you're asking for and plays the intermediary role. That goes a long way in making sure that there's trust, that there are relationships that are developed, that they're with, that, you know, that people don't feel that someone's going behind their back or setting them up.
Another question. What is your view of a board member, particularly the chair of the board, applying for a job that's advertised? What's your view?
My view is that
based on your experience.
Well, anybody, if there's an open position that's been advertised and that person believes they're qualified, I think they have the right to apply.
They have a right.
Sure.
Okay.
They have the right to apply for the job.
They can't be the board chair anymore.
Yeah. Well, they would have to step down as board chair if they
while they apply.
No.
Oh
no.
No. If they get the job, they step down.
Yes.
But if they didn't,
no.
It's okay.
And you know, if you have appropriate hiring policies and procedures that include job descriptions, that include a set of questions that are the same for every person you interview, that every person that's interviewed is given the same amount of time in an interview, that if you allocate an hour to an interview, that everybody that interviews gets that 1 hour, that they're all asked the exact same questions, and that you score their responses on a rubric, then you should be able to cover yourself whether that person gets the job or not. But you need to document. And you need to prepare ahead of time. Everybody should be asked the same things. One person should not get a 15-minute interview and your board chair get a 2-hour interview. That kind of thing.
I guess the question is conflict of interest. And I was wondering this because this was brought up at KPF KPFK. Also, if a board member of the LSB or of the PNB wanted to do had an idea for a show for the station, would that be appropriate for them to put that forth? Because I guess one would think the other side of that argument would be that because of your position, you have access that the listeners don't have or other people wouldn't have,
yeah.
And it gives you an advantage. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that somebody who was working in the best interests of the organization and had an idea for a show might present that idea in a way that would not benefit them. In other words, they had an idea for a show. Here's a great idea for a show. I hope you can find somebody that can do it. You know, not, hey, give me a show. I mean, it's all about kind of common sense and putting the organization before your own needs.
Exactly.
And then it's about writing good policy and monitoring that policy.
Perception.
Because perception often becomes reality.
It is. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying, Casey. I was with you 100% until you got to the part to answer Lucette's question about directors or chairs getting jobs. This is just me personally. I don't think that any director should get a job. There should be a period, I would say maybe 3 years, which is a term on an LSB, that you can apply for a job and get a job. I don't see any difference between that and the lobbyist mentality. No, that's just me.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. This is something you're going to have to talk to Dan about because I don't know whether you can specifically request someone from applying for a job.
You can't.
Stop somebody from applying for a job or not. I don't think you can.
You can.
But.
If they're on the board.
Yeah.
But you also may want to take into consideration whether this is a position that might benefit from someone that had specific knowledge of the organization or specific history, with the organization. You might benefit from that. It depends. I think it depends one way or the other, and you have to consider all of those things.
I think my difficulty with this is that it automatically compromises your position. For example, if you have to go to the GM or the ED to evaluate that person, then what is that saying or doing if you have to rely on that person to interview you for that job? That's my problem. That's my difficulty.
Well, I think that's valid. I personally think that if somebody is working in the best interest of the corporation, they would consider those things, and I probably would not apply for a job on which I was a member of the board. I wouldn't do that. I would think that it would put the organization in a situation where they have to make that decision, and that's something I wouldn't do. But that's a personal decision. I mean, I will tell you that, you know, about a year ago, we hired someone that was on our board for a program management position, but we asked them to resign from the board before they applied. They came to us and said, I'm going to apply, and we asked them to. But that was a decision we made. You have to decide what those policies are and pass those policies, you know, across to your legal advisor as well.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
You're saying also that the policy must be in place before you act, right?
Yes.
It must be in place, and then you can act. That'll give justification for the act.
That's right.
So, Casey, your person, just the mere fact that he or she applied, the person had to resign?
I said to this person, listen, I think you'd be great for this, but I cannot afford the perception of hiring someone on the board. If you really want to do this, I'd like you to resign from the board. I'd hate to lose you from the board, and I can't guarantee you'll get the job once you resign.
Right. In our case, we had a chair who was going to apply for a position, and my advice to them was to check to find out from the foundation if there was any legal reason why she could or should stay on the board.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. You have to decide what works for your organization. The only thing I will say is once you decide what that is, you need to apply it consistently.
Excuse me, George. I think it's time.
There's a difference between the legal implication and the moral implication.
You're absolutely right.
Especially in this organization.
You're absolutely
right.
There's
a big difference.
Yes, you're right. And so you need to decide as a group in good faith what is best for the organization and set your policy. And you need to do that in good faith without regard to consideration of who might this might, which individuals this might affect.
Not the policy after the fact.
Yeah. Excuse me, Chair. Sorry. You said there was 7 minutes. I have 4:13. Could we synchronize our clocks and watches and phones? You said 7 minutes.
So it's five.
One little question about the example you gave.
What time do you have?
One bit of information I'd like to get from you about the analogy example you gave when you said the person was asked to resign and there was no guarantee they'd get the job. Mm-hmm. Was there also no guarantee that if they didn't get the job that they would be allowed to take their place back on the board?
Nope. Interesting.
Well, yes, but most boards are not decided by election and by, you know, I mean, most organizations seek out people with specific skills that the organization needs and ask them to join the board. So what happened in this particular instance may not apply to this organization.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Right, makes sense.
Okay, so Israel is passing out a whole bunch of stuff right now that we're not going to get to. So I just want to kind of go over what you've got. One of the things that I've given you is a list of suggested policies and procedures that you may want to ask for. You may, obviously, you don't want to throw this list at staff and say, give us all of this. But you may want to look at this and say, which of these do we need or which are our priorities? You may want to ask staff which of these already exist and to provide you with copies of those that exist so that you can review those first. And those that don't exist, prioritize which ones you think you need first. All right, but this is a good guideline to consider. And then what you might want to do is set up an ongoing policy book so that everybody's got the same thing, and any time it's changed, everything's changed. Okay. I've given you some information about a consent agenda, setting up a consent agenda so that many of the things that don't need constant deliberation or lengthy argument might be put on a consent agenda so that you can approve things quickly and get those things out of the way for your meeting. A consent agenda does not preclude public participation. It doesn't. And so there's some information on how you might handle that. But typically, if you've got your items on your agenda numbered and things, and your committees have given you their resolutions and motions ahead of time, and everybody's got them ahead of time and have reviewed them and is prepared, then you identify the ones you feel you need to discuss or have questions on, and public can identify the things they feel they need to comment on. You pull those out of the consent agenda and you approve everything else with one vote. You should be able to take a look at that and see if that can move your work along. Now, it will only move your work along if you decide in good faith that you don't need to pull out every single item on the consent agenda to discuss and argue. That's the only way it'll work. All right, I've given you a big handout about executive sessions, how to use them regularly and wisely, how to avoid criticism from using executive sessions improperly, from not reporting out on executive sessions, what you can include in executive session and what you should not discuss in executive session. I would say that probably the biggest thing to look at with your executive sessions is how you report back on what happened in an executive session. Typically, an organization has an executive session as a regular part of every meeting, either at the beginning or at the end. And on your following meeting agenda, you have at the bottom typically a report that says this is what happened in the previous executive session. So it may be we discussed Doe versus Pacifica. This is a lawsuit that claims
improper hiring procedures, and you leave it at that. But you're reporting out to the public specifically what you discussed and what that is in general terms. You don't give details about who said what or how you discussed it. But that if you put those at the end of every agenda and report back on what your executive session was last time, the public is informed about what you're talking about. There aren't questions about whether or not you're discussing things you shouldn't be in executive session.
I wish our general counsel was here to hear this. Where is he? He just left. Yeah, he should have heard
okay.
this.
And also, you would report the what you the conclusion you came up with, the results?
The results. If for example, what you were discussing was litigation, and in ongoing litigation, it was Doe versus Pacifica, and for 3 months, each time you discussed it, you just put on there this lawsuit claims unlawful hiring practices. Once there was a settlement, in your executive session report would be approved a settlement of $20,000 on this, and that's all you would say.
And you would give the exact amount
yes.
for the public?
Yes.
That's what, thank you.
Yes, once it's approved and final, once it is final. Right. If it were a personnel matter, you don't just put personnel matters. You say discussed executive director evaluation, and you leave it at that. You don't say what the evaluation was. You don't say, you know, how many people were for. You say this is what we discussed, and you report it back. And if you report it back on your agendas every time for what you did at the previous meeting,
they can follow.
The public, you're being transparent. Okay? Yeah. That's it, except that you've got something on minimizing the chances of an employment-related lawsuit. You might want to review that. Yeah. And you have, as I mentioned at the beginning, a checklist to evaluate your board of directors. If you go through this individually and look at which things you've already met, which things need work, you might want to come together and compare those and see where you're in agreement and where you're not. Then you can start prioritizing which things you need to work on first. Okay? Yes. Thank you.
There was a suggestion that we... There was a suggestion that we take a break.
You asked.
I'd suggest we get up and stretch for 30 seconds if you need to, and let's continue on. We're a little bit into Dan's time anyway, so let's just do that. I do need to stretch myself. Dan, you're on.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone, and let me thank Casey for an excellent presentation. Not only did she have a lot to say that I think was very useful, but also she covered some of the things that I was going to cover, so that will actually make my presentation shorter, which I'm sure you'll be happy about. A lot of the things I was going to cover are in the handout that I prepared called The Rights and Duties of Members of the Pacifica National Board and the Local Station Boards. And you hopefully all have that, so I always feel like I don't have to read something that you can read as well as I do yourselves. I just want to emphasize a few of the points that are stated there. We have a board full of lawyers, both licensed and unlicensed, and there are lots of folks that have a lot of views of what they think the law is and what it should be, and I don't mean to be elitist and think that lawyers have some special knowledge that other people don't, but sometimes, as they say, a little learning can get in the way of understanding, and that's true about Pacifica. One of the reasons for that is that it's impossible to figure out what everyone's rights and responsibilities are simply by reading our bylaws. The bylaws have to be read in conjunction with the whole body of law that exists in the United States, many of which impact Pacifica. For example, you look at the Federal Communications Act or the laws that govern the Federal Communications Commission, things like that. We're a radio network, and those laws are very important to what we do. Also particularly relevant is the California Nonprofit Corporation Law. Pacifica, as I'm sure everyone knows, but just to be reminded, is a corporation that is headquartered and licensed and chartered in the state of California, so California law applies. And just in case anybody's curious, if you were filing a lawsuit against Pacifica in Texas or Washington or New York, the courts in those states would have to follow the California Nonprofit Corporation Law in making decisions, at least in areas where that is covered. The other thing that's important, and of course we're all experts on it, is Robert's Rules of Order. If you go all the way through the bylaws and get to the end, you see that Robert's Rules apply in situations where our own bylaws are not explicit. So that's important, and we have really a lot of people on the board who are very knowledgeable about Robert's Rules. The general thrust of what Casey said about the authority of the board is laid out in our articles of incorporation and in our bylaws, and they're pretty clear. The board is in charge of everything. There's no doubt about that. People have pointed that out earlier and in different respects, but I want to also stress not only the board's power, but its responsibility. And that responsibility includes ensuring compliance with the law, ensuring the financial health of the foundation, appointing as well as discharging the executive director, the CFO, and other officers, and overseeing their conduct and taking care of business. The local station boards, and this is sometimes not clearly understood, but should and must be clearly understood. What the local station boards are committees of this board. The long and the short of it is that the local station boards are committees of this board. This board and the bylaws delegate authority to the local station boards. This board can increase the responsibilities of the local station boards. And I don't know that I need to say a lot more about that. The local station boards play a role, a particularly important role, in choosing the general managers. I think if there's one thing that maybe we can possibly applaud ourselves on at the beginning of 2009 is that I believe for the first time since the takeover and the counterattack, which resulted in the writing of the bylaws, each of our stations now has a general manager. I mean, it's only taken 5 years, but we've accomplished that task, and obviously there's room for improvement, but it's at least an accomplishment that each station actually does have a general manager without the name interim in front of it. Hopefully we'll soon get to the same place with having program directors, and that's something that I'm going to comment on a little bit more later. But it's so amazing when you think of what we are and thinking of Casey's presentation, right? I mean, you know, Casey's presentation would have made sense if we were running a food bank or the Red Cross or a youth empowerment organization or a network of radio. And that's fine. I mean, there are certain legalities that apply to any nonprofit corporation, but we are a radio network. And I think it would be interesting for some historian of Pacifica to go through a year's worth of meetings, and perhaps they could be given access to the tapes even of executive sessions. Like John, okay, and say, well, how many hours have we spent in meetings in the last year, meetings of the national board, the local board, and of those hours, how many of those hours were spent discussing our programming? Would it be 1%? 2%? Not much more than that, you know. It's really something to think about when we talk about what the role of this board is. I want to actually, because I think it's important, and at risk of unhappiness, talk about, in particular, the provisions of the California Corporations Code that set out the responsibilities of board members to ensure the health and success of this foundation.